We call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water and open up a work session for introduction of a committee measure and remind members that we do this generally as a formality, not to indicate our support or opposition to the measure in front of us, but just to get the bill into the system. This is LC 2590, and if there is a motion, I would accept it. Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 2590, dated January 23rd, 2009, be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Barnhart moves that LC 2590, dated January 23rd, 2009, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Is there objection? If not, seeing none, the measure is introduced as a committee bill. Thank you, members. I'll close the work session and open a public hearing on House Bill 2186. And we are picking up where we left off last Tuesday when we had our first public hearing on the bill. Since that time, it has come to my attention there are approximately 14 million people in the U.S. who deal in aftermarket auto parts, and each one of them has written each member of the committee. I have asked the department, the agency, DEQ, to work with the folks who think they may be affected under the bill to see what kind of resolution they can reach around that issue in particular, and I think we'll be hearing more from DEQ later today about how they intend to move forward on that issue and others that were raised last Tuesday. But we're going to carry on with testimony, and I'm going to start with anybody who traveled more than 100 miles to get here and then go with folks who are on last week's sign-in list. We're going to be limiting testimony. We do have a lot of folks signed up, so ask people to try to stick to about 3 minutes in their presentation, and I'll be calling you up in panels that may not reflect, you know, the fact that you may not all have the same position on the issue, so the composition of the panel is not necessarily meaningful, but we'll hear from a panel, we'll take questions, and then we will move on. So let's start with a couple of folks who have traveled some distance to be here. It looks like Stuart Leibowitz and Mark McCallum. Oh, Mark is a Corvallis of more than 100 miles. I don't think so.
No.
So I'm gonna stick with Stuart and.
Actually, I traveled from Florence.
Oh, from Florence. Well, then that probably does qualify. At least comes closer. So you're welcome to come up. So Stuart Leibowitz, Mark McCallum, and Nick Oliver. If you three would. And in any order, we can start with you and go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Stuart Leibowitz. I'm from Roseburg, Oregon, and I'm a member of the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition. And we are part of a larger statewide coalition called the Healthy Climate Partnership, and we're very concerned about the issue of global warming. As many of you know, the International Panel on Climate Change has made it very clear that we are already at a point where we cannot avoid serious impacts of global warming. We're here right now to make sure that the climate crisis does not turn into a climate catastrophe. And scientists have made it very clear that the time for action is now. We do not have the luxury of waiting any longer. And I come from Douglas County, and we pride ourselves as the timber capital of the world. And we are very heavily reliant on the timber industry. A couple of weeks ago, the U.S. Geological Survey released a report indicating that forests were starting to decrease. And after looking at all the elements that could possibly account for it, they wound up coming up with one and only one reason that this is happening. And that reason was global warming. We cannot afford the economic impact, the human impact of global warming any more than we are suffering now. Future impacts such as catastrophic fires, And water shortages are in the offing down the road, as well as the impact on our salmon. And this particular bill is one element of the solution. We have been involved in the global warming issue long enough to know there is no one magic bullet. It's all part of a puzzle, and this is a key element of that puzzle. By establishing a lower carbon fuel standard, we have an opportunity to impact this sector of the economy and make a difference in the global warming picture. So I urge you to look at this very seriously, that this is part of a larger package that we are committed to, and to leave a legacy to our children and our grandchildren that says, in the time of crisis, at a time when it was a time to stand up and take that leadership step, we were there, and we made a difference. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Leibowitz.
Hello, my name is Mark McCallum. I'm from Corvallis, Oregon, and I'm a mechanical engineer. I was just made aware of this House bill as of last night, and there are a number of details within the publications that I've had access to that bring me great concern. The assumption that the distribution of aftermarket motor vehicle parts, including but not limited to tires, if alternatives are available that decrease greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles, this is a very, very broad statement. The automotive industry as a whole produces vehicles that are based upon the saleability of those products at a point in time. Most vehicles that are produced nowadays do not utilize the maximum efficiency potential of those vehicles. For one example, is exhaust systems. All right, most of the vehicles that come from the automotive industry are based around providing the least cost solution, not the maximum performance. And so there are many automotive providers that supply aftermarket parts that produce higher efficiency, better gas mileage, less waste. And based upon that one example, including and not limited to tires as well, basic efficiency of a vehicle is designated by the least amount of fuel being used to propel that vehicle down the road. So are you just looking at engine efficiency? What about lightweight body panels? Then you're going to get into the conflict with the National Transportation and Safety Board about impact protection. It doesn't. It's like a big can of worms here. And so my suggestion at this point in time is to request additional information from the aftermarket manufacturers as to what they can provide. One of the most simplest things that a person can do today, having a vehicle manufactured since 1996 on, is to replace the computer chip that's inside the vehicle with the economizer chip. It's $400, but it'll get you anywhere between 10 and 15% better fuel economy without any impact whatsoever to the emissions of that vehicle. This is the kind of technology that we should be legislating for. Set standards that auto manufacturers can meet, but not technology that they must utilize.
Thanks very much for your testimony. And as I mentioned earlier to anybody who wasn't in the room, we will be hearing from DEQ later about their intentions with that provision of the bill, the provision that you mentioned, and possible amendments that they may be interested in pursuing by working with folks like yourself from the industry. So thanks for being here. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nick Oliver. I'm the Executive Director for Bike Pack of Oregon. And I feel that HB 2186 is a bill that the citizens of Oregon do not need at this time. This bill would restrict the use of available parts for repair or improvement on a vehicle. For example, the gentleman that spoke just before me mentioned the tires. the original equipment manufacturer tires that are on, put on vehicles are not necessarily the tires best suited for whatever vehicle's use. If you concentrate too much on just replacing that with original equipment again, then you're taking away the possibility of attention towards the proper air pressure, towing, whatever, you know, handling capabilities, things that it could improve the vehicle's operations, as well as decreasing any necessary risks or any greenhouse gases, as the statements go. These issues in dealing with fuel economy and so forth are best left to the federal government and not to the state agencies. And it is up to I feel it should be left up to the individual owner of their vehicle, because a lot of vehicles on the road are not new, they're old. And a lot of repair shops rely on aftermarket parts to repair those older vehicles, because they don't make new ones anymore. So they have the aftermarket, that's all they have to rely on. And without this resource, we're hurting that industry and possibly putting a lot of people out of work. And in this tough economic times, we've got to think about that as well. We can't just dismiss people's jobs for something without due consideration. You have before you a paper that I have written up that discusses this in greater detail. These problems are all important. Greenhouse gases or global warming, well, I'm not going to go into that. But at any rate, we need to worry about more on taking care of vehicles, making them improvements to them, and not keeping them stagnated in a specific area without due consideration. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Great. Well, thanks very much for being here, and I hope that you'll be able to stick around to hear more testimony today, including some possible response to the concerns that the two of you have raised. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's move now to the list that we worked from last Tuesday, a number of folks who did not get to testify, and I'm going to start. Is Daryl Fuller here? Also, Andrea Durbin, is she here? Hi, Andrea. Jeremiah Bauman.
In any order.
Mr. Fuller. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Northwest Auto Trades Association. And this afternoon, I'm going to muster all of my lobbying skills and testify in favor of this bill by explaining all the reasons why we don't like it. And what I mean to say by that is that we've had a number of good conversations with the DEQ since the last hearing, and we're strongly in favor of the bill they want, although it's not necessarily the bill you have in front of you. And there are some, I guess we would label them unintended consequences of the way that the bill is drafted, and DEQ has invited us to participate in a work group to try to draft amendments that not only reach the environmental goals that I think we all agree on, but eliminate some of the concerns that industry has based on how broadly the bill is written. I'll mention just a couple of examples and then conclude my testimony. The bill in Part D includes restrictions and prohibitions on the sale and distribution of aftermarket motor parts. It doesn't restrict the use or ownership of them. So essentially what the bill would do as written is it would force anybody that wanted something to just go across straight lines and buy it from somebody else. But there's nothing in the bill that would prohibit you from using one of those items that might be restricted for sale in the state of Oregon. And we certainly don't think that that's the intent to push the aftermarket part economy outside of the state of Oregon in order for people to get the parts that they want to have. We're strongly in favor of any efforts that business and the DEQ can cooperate on to provide more education to consumers on things like rolling resistance on tires so that consumers can make good choices. One of the concerns we have is that there may not be a standard out there on what rolling resistance means. So the rolling resistance on one tire may be completely different than the rolling resistance on another tire, even though they have the same rolling resistance number attached to them. And so we would want to make sure before we go down that road that we actually know what rolling resistance means and that there is some sort of standard that everybody applies to that factor, so people are talking about apples and apples instead of apples and oranges. And finally, we would be strongly in favor of rules, for example, that would require service and repair businesses to inflate tires if they happen to be low, but we would not be in favor of rules that would require certain people to buy air compressors if they don't have them now. Certainly in this economy, we wouldn't want to put the rules in a position of forcing people to spend money they don't have on products that they're not currently using. But for those businesses that currently have an air compressor and have the ability to do that, it certainly should be encouraged. So we had, like I said, a number of very good conversations with DEQ, and we're encouraged by the direction that they seem to want to head with the legislation. We appreciate the opportunity to continue to work with them, and our hope, as is their hope, is that we'll be able to come back with amendments that everybody can support. And thank you.
Thank you. I'm right on 3 minutes. Mr. Bauman, Ms. Durbin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeremiah Bauman with Environment Oregon, a statewide membership-based advocacy organization. Pleased to be here today to testify in favor of House Bill 2186. I thought that in light of the last hearing, it might be helpful to provide a little bit of context on how we see this bill fitting into Oregon's overall efforts to reduce greenhouse gas pollution and meet the state's goals for that pollution reduction. My first overall point of context is that at the hearing last week on Senate Bill 80 with the counterpart Senate committee and on the concept of a cap-and-trade program, we heard a lot about the distinction between a cap-and-trade program that coordinates overall activity toward meeting greenhouse gas reduction goals and complementary measures, measures that take specific actions for specific sectors to contribute toward meeting the same greenhouse gas reduction goals. House Bill 2186 is really a bill full of complementary measures, those exact types of provisions that we heard a lot of support for by folks who were not very supportive of a cap-and-trade program. So most of these measures get at transportation and a few other products and the greenhouse gas emissions associated specifically with those. When it comes to dealing with the transportation side, which is about 40% of the global warming pollution in Oregon, there are basically three things we have to do. One is move toward cleaner cars, cleaner engine technology. The second is cleaner fuels that those engines are burning. And the third is to reduce our overall dependence on driving, specifically single-passenger car trips where there are better options that could be made available. The reason that's important context is that we heard testimony last week that that third element, that a lot of folks from the trucking industry in particular and some of the folks in the transportation sector are supporting a whole raft of provisions that are primarily in the governor's transportation package. Those almost all go toward reducing our dependence on driving, increasing funding for alternatives, and planning our land use and transportation systems to move toward that goal. This bill doesn't really get into that, nor is that alone enough. This bill gets into the two other pieces, cleaner fuels and cleaner vehicles. So that's just the context piece of this. And the only important point of that is that we really do have to address all three of those provisions if we're going to meet the goals we've got to meet by 2020 that scientists have said are necessary. In terms of the specifics in this bill, just two provisions I'll comment on. First, the clean fuels standard that is authorized at Section 3.1a. The low carbon fuel standard is, I think, a very smart policy mechanism that several states are developing right now, and that Oregon should be working with them to develop a version of it that will work for Oregon. What it basically does is it requires fuel providers to gradually reduce the carbon content of the fuel they're providing. It builds on Oregon's biofuel standard in a couple of, I think, important and interesting ways. One is it basically puts all the fuels out there, biofuels, electricity, et cetera, on a level playing field where the competition is only for reducing carbon content. What that means for our biofuels program is that the sustainable, lowest carbon fuels, those that are produced locally and those that are produced not by competing with existing food crops but are from agricultural waste or cellulosic sources, those sources will then have a leg up in under a low carbon fuel standard. The way that California and other states are also developing this, it is one other interesting thing, which is it creates an explicit provision that fuel providers can basically help people transition to electric cars and plug-in hybrids as an alternative to biofuels. So rather than picking one technology, we're really opening the door to all the different new clean vehicle, clean fuel technologies that are coming down the pike. And I think that's a really important provision. The last piece I'll comment on very briefly is the provision that would authorize programs for heavy-duty truck improvements that reduce aerodynamic drag or otherwise improve fuel efficiency. This is not an effort to compete with federal fuel efficiency standards, but rather there's a set of relatively practical, simple measures that can be taken. You'll see the attachments that are put on the cabs of trucks, or they go on the backs of trucks or the bottoms, that make the truck more aerodynamic. These are very straightforward, practical measures. They typically cost, they have a payback period of less than 2 years because of the reduced fuel consumption. So it's that kind of practical measure that we're hoping this bill will empower the department to pursue.
Thank you. Ms. Durbin.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Andrea Durbin, Executive Director with Oregon Environmental Council. And the Oregon Environmental Council supports House Bill 2186. Passage of this bill is essential because it enables the state to pursue different approaches to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and meet the state's goal. And there is no silver bullet in answer in addressing global warming. This bill identifies several approaches that will work, all of which were discussed in the governor's transportation stakeholder process last year as well. The low rolling resistance tires will improve fuel efficiency, save on energy costs, and decrease greenhouse gas emissions. An idling program has the co-benefits of reducing greenhouse gas emissions and reducing toxic emissions that harm human health. But of course, a key tool for reducing emissions and diversifying the state's transportation fuels is through the low carbon fuel standard. A low carbon fuel standard would ensure that the carbon intensity of Oregon's vehicle fuels is reduced by at least 10% by 2020. This is a very doable goal. We're talking 1% a year. Through a low carbon fuel standard, Oregon would have the ability to diversify its transportation fuel supplies, decrease the greenhouse gas emissions emitted by those fuels, and establish a market for cleaner burning fuels and alternative vehicles. The standard utilizes market-based mechanisms to allow providers to choose how they reduce emissions while responding to consumer demand. It is not prescriptive, and it does not choose winners. The standard is measured on a life cycle basis to include all emissions from fuel consumption and production, including upstream emissions. For example, providers may purchase and blend more biofuels into gasoline products, like Jeremy Meyer just mentioned. They can purchase credits from electric utilities supplying low-carbon electrons to electric passenger vehicles. They can diversify into low-carbon hydrogen and compressed natural gas vehicles. And then there are many strategies that have not yet been developed. Without a doubt, this standard will accelerate the transition to a new generation of fuels and cleaner vehicles. We heard at last week's hearing from the California Air Resources Board about their efforts to develop the rules and implement this standard. Oregon can benefit from this work by adopting similar rules, modified where necessary to reflect Oregon's fuel supply, but avoiding costly efforts to reinvent the wheel. OEC recommends that Oregon's implementation of this standard follows California's. We've also heard that the northeastern states are developing a regional low-carbon fuel standard. In fact, they're looking at heating fuels as well, which is something that we hope that the committee will consider. In addition to the climate benefits and greater cost reduction for consumers, Oregon should adopt this standard to ensure that we do not become a market for dirtier fuels in the region because of lagging requirements. We've already experienced this with higher levels of benzene and gasoline sold in the United States than in other U.S. states, and the health of Oregonians has been negatively impacted because of it. Oregon requirements need to keep up and make sure that consumers have access to the cleanest fuels on the market. It has been suggested that this legislation is too detailed and burdensome for DEQ and that the agency is not participatory enough. This bill embodies an appropriate distinction between the legislative and the regulatory functions of the state. It marries the broad goals of reducing greenhouse gas emissions with the specifics of identifying different means for doing so. It is then up to the agency to work out the details, the rules, during the rulemaking process. Oregon law mandates that this process be open and participatory and consider impacts on businesses and consumers. Our experience is that DEQ takes this requirement seriously and ensures rigorous involvement. We would expect nothing less to implement this bill. In closing, passage of this bill demonstrates that Oregon is serious about meeting the state's emission reduction goals and has the co-benefits of protecting the public health by reducing toxic emissions. It will save consumers money in fuel costs, and over the long term, it will accelerate the transition to cleaner fuels and vehicles. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your comments about the volume of mail this has generated and the fact that DEQ is coming in to sort of tell us the latest. But I wanted to ask the three of you real quickly, given where we are right now, is there a circumstance you could imagine your association or your membership not supporting an economic situation in Oregon, not supporting this bill or some form of it?
Representative Gilliam, if the outcome of the bill would be higher energy costs, then certainly. But in fact, I think one of the impetus behind this bill and one of the benefits of this bill is that it will reduce fuel costs, energy costs, and help stabilize and give consumers more options for cleaner fuels, better vehicles, alternative vehicles. So in the long term, particularly when we've seen the rise of energy prices, petroleum costs are volatile and have an impact on our pocketbooks, we need to be taking steps today to make sure that those prices will go up again, and we want to make sure that we diversify all options possible to give people lower cost options, energy costs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, certainly if ever there were circumstances of today's economic circumstances would be those in which we have to look at everything through the lens of how this affects families and businesses and the overall economy. One of the main messages I'd like to communicate about global warming pollution reductions generally is that if we choose the right ones, they almost all, while they might increase the price of, say, gasoline per gallon, they will tend to reduce households' or businesses' total fuel costs because they're giving them other alternatives, competing with that gasoline or diesel, or they're increasing fuel efficiency and the efficient use of that fuel, so they're using less total fuel, much the same way we've seen energy efficiency programs cause small increases in per kilowatt-hour electric rates, but reduce households and businesses' total electricity bill, far exceeding the short-term rate increase. So all of the measures that I can think of right now that we're supporting in terms of global warming pollution reductions, we see as absolutely net wins to the economy overall as well as to households and businesses.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, yes.
Quick follow-up, and then we'll let you move on. I appreciate the answers. My concern, obviously, is, and you don't need to comment on this, but just that we have a difference of opinion, and I appreciate the long-term view and your concern for our state. I believe that's sincere. But the difference of opinion is if in this economy we end up hurting people in the short run that can't recover because we have a pretty lofty goal, then that would be very unfortunate, and that's my concern. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? I have a couple. One, I want to pick up on a point that Ms. Durbin made about delegating this authority to EQC. We heard a lot of concerns with that approach to lawmaking last week, both on this bill and Senate Bill 80. Especially for some of the newer legislators here, we will hear, well, look, that's your job to legislate and come up with these rules. What can you tell us about the history and experience with this type of process that would provide some comfort to those of us who think, well, we want to have the final say on each and every detail?
Mr. Chair, it is not unusual for the legislative body to set kind of broad parameters and then ask the appropriate agency to determine the details. It certainly was something that happened for establishing the energy efficiency standards and making sure that energy efficiency standards for appliances can continue to evolve and are kept up to date. And certainly working out the details of how some of these programs might work, those are details that really are appropriate to be worked out within a multi-stakeholder process with everyone who's involved and impacted under the auspices of the appropriate agency. And from where we sit, we trust DEQ. We think that the DEQ has done a good job. We have not agreed with every rule that the DEQ has developed, obviously, but we've been participants in that process, and as have many of our people who we work with from industry. So I think that, you know, setting those broad parameters, working with the agencies, letting the agencies who do their work to develop the specific rules for implementation through that multi-stakeholder process is the most effective and efficient way to set policy.
Mr. Chair, I would, I guess, just add a couple of thoughts. One is certainly, I think as we heard last week, there's a lot of concern about the breadth of authority in this bill, and I think I would agree there's probably some room to provide more specificity to the intent. I think some of the programs that have been described by DEQ, and certainly that I've been describing, are not even elucidated clearly enough in the current language to be clear that's the program as opposed to a broader authority over everything related to a certain topical area. So on the one hand, I certainly think there is some room to provide some reasonably more specific and clear direction to the agency. On the other hand, I do think it's worth noting that there is a long history in Oregon of the legislature giving broad policy direction. The vehicle standards that DEQ adopted in 2006 were adopted pursuant to authority that I believe isn't more than a sentence or two long, that the legislature passed in the 70s. Many of the sort of foundational environmental laws this legislature passed are little more than the DEQ may adopt limits on motor vehicle emissions. And certainly these are the kinds of issues that quickly get very technical, trying to figure out exactly how a petroleum distributor can buy credits from a utility for providing electricity to electric cars is a technical issue that I probably wouldn't wish it on any individual person to try to figure out on their own. And probably an agency is best set up to work with other agencies across the country to figure that out. But there does need to be a specificity that the legislative intent is clear.
Thanks. Go ahead, Representative Smith.
As Brother Gilliam mentioned, we have received some degree of feedback on the bill. None of it has been, as far as I can tell you, but from in my district, but I did take, most of them seem to come from automobile enthusiasts who cared obviously deeply about their cars. There are a few that I noted, what are you thinking, not sure what the motives are behind this bill. I personally prefer a gas tax, and my favorite, get smart before we have to beat you to death with a shoe. That was my favorite one. But my question, and I don't know that these emails in particular had its intended effect on my thinking, but I do want to ask, and I'll ask you, Jeremiah, because as far as I can tell, we only have 9 more days that we can ask you questions, and I think this is public, and I do want to say for the record, thank you so much for your service to the state with what you've been doing. Jeremiah, for those who don't know, recently was hired to go join Senator Merkley to help work on federal policy, and we'll miss you around these parts. And I wanted to make sure I got a chance in these last 9 days to say that. So I'll direct my question to you. I'm not sure all those emails had their intended effect, but I am curious, are there ways that you can see specific things, and we'll be hearing more about this, things that we can do to improve the bill, specific places where we'd cabin authority of the DEQ, for instance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, thank you, I guess, first, I think, for that question.
Which part would
comment.
You like
that? I won't comment on that piece. I think on the aftermarket parts piece in particular, this is a perfect example of where there are a fairly discrete set of automobile components where there are known problems related to greenhouse gas or impacts directly on fuel efficiency. So, for example, the tires that come with a car have a certain fuel efficiency that's not only what it starts after, it's what the consumer, in fact, expects when they see that miles per gallon rating and buy the car, but the replacement tire you buy, either you can't get one that provides the same fuel efficiency, or there just isn't the information to empower the consumer to know that. So there's a set of discrete problems like that, and I could probably do some research within a few days, get a list to the committee of, I think, what some of those options are. And that's, I think, the direction we want to be going with this, and I think there's certainly a way to provide clarity that that's what we're talking about and not some broad prohibition on aftermarket parts per se.
Thanks.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bauman, as you consider potential clarifications on this bill that you just mentioned, I heard you mention in your testimony some parameters around what a low-carbon fuel standard means. For the record, could you just reiterate what a low-carbon fuel standard means to you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, absolutely. In my mind, there are a couple of key components of a well-designed low-carbon fuel standard. First of all, by low-carbon fuel standard, what I take that to mean is a target percentage reduction in the carbon content of fuel by a certain date. So I believe California is pursuing a goal of a 10% reduction by 2020. Beyond that, I think there are a couple of parameters. One, it should be certain to be based on a life cycle assessment of the carbon emissions associated with that product. And the key there is, as I mentioned, giving the preference that local biofuels deserve, for example, over biofuels transported across the country or across the ocean, because they, in fact, do have a lower carbon content when you look at their total life cycle. So life cycle impact is critical. And then the third element that I would add is making sure that multiple vehicle and fuel technologies can all participate in that program, in particular electric and plug-in hybrids, which are likely in the medium term and long term likely to, I think, exceed most of the other alternatives right now as one of the best options, but we need to be moving and making sure we're not picking technologies without regard to the total impact of that they have on global warming.
Great. Thank you very much for testifying. Oh, did you have a question?
Just
sorry,
one
Representative
more, Boone. Grabbing Jeremiah before he leaves, too. One of the things that was discussed last week was the number of miles that an electric car can travel without a recharge. And it causes me to think of people in Rep. Jensen's district and some areas of my district, which is quite large. And if I had an electric car and it quit after 100 miles, I would be getting a quarter of the way across my district in any direction except out to sea. And hopefully I would not be driving out to sea. So I'm just wondering if you could comment on that and the technology and making sure that in any policy we make in this body that we wouldn't constrain people who live in the rural areas by that sort of thing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, that's an excellent question. Two thoughts on that. One is that there's actually a range of electric technologies today. Plug-in hybrids in particular, there's a lot of enthusiasm around because they plug into a standard home outlet and they can go anywhere from 40 to over 100 miles on a charge, which is more than the vast majority of people drive in an average day, and they plug in overnight. So you rarely have to even think about that problem. But more importantly, as it relates to this bill, given that it's certainly true that there are plenty of places and plenty of people who do drive a lot more than that every day, that's one of the key benefits of a low-carbon fuel standard, is that it sets up multiple technologies and multiple options, and the requirement isn't that every vehicle or every driver reduce their carbon impact at all. It's that across a fuel distributor's entire sales in Oregon, they reduce the total carbon content through biofuel, through electric cars, through compressed natural gas, if that's available. So it gives a lot of flexibility both to how the regulated fuel distributor complies, and it's regulating the fuel distributor across the whole state, not a mandate on any particular community or person or vehicle.
Just a quick follow-up.
Yeah, follow-up.
And just thank you for that, and just to keep in mind as we go forward on some of these bills that doesn't get left behind, because I drive well over 100 miles a day in one direction, and then I have to come back. So,
thanks. I have a hard time acknowledging that this might be the last time. Oh, Representative Jensen.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not wanting to be left out with the opportunity to have one more go.
Poor Chairman.
You mentioned in your testimony that there are three issues, clean fuels, clean vehicles, etc. I note that you omitted one thing that I think should be maybe included in there, and that if we're talking about transportation and automobiles, is speed. And I'm finding this absolutely fascinating as I listen to the hearings on this, and I see us running all over the place chasing like a little kitten chasing its tail for all of the new and wonderful sort of things to do some of this. And at our disposal is a very, very simple solution to somewhere between 10-20% increase in fuel economy in whatever the car, or hybrid except an electric or something
that you have by simply reducing the speed on it. So just for the record, I do have a bill coming. I don't know whether the chair will give me a hearing on that bill or not.
I'll sign on to it.
If we're going to talk about this issue, if we're serious about this issue, how do we leave out the most obvious?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I agree. Slower driving is a critical way to reduce fuel consumption, and I actually consider it part of sort of clean cars, more fuel efficient use of the vehicle, but you're absolutely right, it's not really part of that, and it's just a piece of a whole broad set of just individual education behavior things people can be doing to reduce impact across the board.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Jensen.
To follow up a little bit. Against my better judgment as a as a representative from Eastern Oregon, I ventured into the world of the unknown and bought a Prius. For the record, Mr. Chair, it is a red Prius. But I've checked this pretty carefully with that, and I have the opportunity because it's a fairly lengthy drive back and forth from here to Pendleton. I have the opportunity to, even with the hybrid car, to verify that speed is in fact a significant factor in my mileage that I have on it.
I'll be there with you on that bill, Representative Jensen. I think that was true last session as well. And if you've ever seen Jeremiah poking along in his jalopy in the right lane on I-5 North, you'll know that he walks the walk on the 55 miles per hour. And it is hard to acknowledge that this might be the last time you testify in front of this committee. You've done so much to help educate not only this committee but the Energy and Environment Committee that preceded it. And I know that we'll be working with you in Washington and excited about the fact that you'll be there, and we'll certainly miss your presence and service to lawmakers here. So thanks.
Thank you.
Let's bring up a panel. Let's go with John Ledger. Is he here? We didn't hear from you last week, John.
We did not.
Hard to believe. Katie Fast and Mark Nelson. Is Mark? We'll go ahead and start, and Mark will join.
Mr. Chairman. Pleasure. Members of the committee, I'm John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. I'm going to speak very briefly to the rulemaking aspect of this, although we hope you are careful in whatever you do, and certainly listen to the Truckers Association on this. I think we have a lot of expertise. The issue of rules is very difficult. I used to run an air agency in a different state. I wrote a lot of rules, and we're very familiar with the idea of the tension between rulemaking and policy. And I think rules work very, very well where the agency is looking at essentially technical and mathematical issues. What should be the risk level? What should the range of standards be? They don't work well for policy issues because they're not promulgated by someone who's elected. They're promulgated by an appointed board. One thing I did want to say is there are really extremes in this, and probably the biggest extreme I've ever seen was when Oregon adopted California air tailpipe standards by rule. There was actually a bill in the legislature that addressed it, and I can't remember if it said we do it or don't do it. The bill failed. And then the agency was directed to go ahead, and this was a major policy issue, and it was done purely by rule. And when California gets its waiver from EPA, it will have tailpipe emission standards that are strict, and Oregon will adopt them. Nobody in the legislature had anything to do with that at all, and you won't. Interestingly enough, Washington says that if Oregon does it, then Washington will do it. So we've got a domino effect that I think could go through the entire country and United Nations if we set it up right. But one of the problems that makes people nervous when you do talk about rules like this is Oregon has no legislative veto. There are about six states in the country that have a legislative veto. And they range from where it's an automatic veto every year, every rule sunsets, unless it is extended by resolution. And the legislature can change the rule by resolution, to a legislative veto where rules get pulled in front of a committee, and the committee by resolution can change the rule or reject the rule. And that was one of the issues where the governor of Illinois was impeached because he said that was illegal, and indeed these things have been struck down in many cases, and the legislature said it's not illegal. He went ahead with the rule anyway, and they got the last laugh. So Oregon has no legislative veto at all. What you pass becomes wide open for the widest type of interpretation. The only way you can reverse a rule is to pass a law overriding the rule and having it signed by the governor. And since it's the governor that controls the executive branch agencies, it's not likely to get by him. The other piece is once you give this kind of authority to an agency that they may adopt, and they do, they may certainly unadopt. So if you have a change in governor, that governor can certainly have the rule repealed and do anything else that's within the scope, and you also have no authority or oversight over that whatsoever, absent passing a law which is subject to veto, which probably would be because the agents will be operating under the executive branch orders. So just from looking at this for years, I would urge you to decide what it is you want the agency to do, and in this case, you know, may or may not be acceptable. Right now it's extraordinarily broad. And essentially do a rifle shot at that. If the agency needs more authority, it can come back and ask for it. But once you give it away, especially if it's broad like this, it's gone forever. That agency is the legislature. And rules have the effect of law. You can go to jail quite nicely for violating rules. So I would just urge this body to be very, very careful. DEQ has said they're going to be working with a lot of people looking at this rule, and I look forward to doing that. And I would just let you know that this is an issue that seems to be popping up more this session than any others, and it really should be something you approach with caution.
Thank you, Mr. Ledger. Katie.
Thank you. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. My members have concerns and oppose this legislation as drafted due to its impacts on Oregon's family farmers. Our first concern, there are three, is the broad rulemaking authority to DEQ that John just touched on. Our second concern is with the sale and distribution of aftermarket parts. My members are quite frugal, and they buy the trucks that the truckers retire, and they're able to extend the life of those trucks for many years. They use them seasonally during harvest and usually are traveling short distances or in the field. And with that frugalness that a farmer has, they also utilize used parts to extend the life and make it pencil out, especially in these economic times. So that is our second concern with the legislation, and the third is the development of a low-carbon fuel standard. We are strong proponents of biofuels and the development of biofuels. We're supportive of House Bill 2210 last session. However, have concerns with the development of a low-carbon standard. Biofuels would be a piece of that. And we've heard comments today about that development of biofuels within state would be counted in the fuel standard. However, if you look at the biofuel facilities going on in Oregon now, we do not have the agricultural base to support them. The corn being shipped in for ethanol is coming from the Midwest due to the type of crops we raise here. We do have potential for cellulosic ethanol being developed in the state, but that technology is not here yet. And is probably some time away. I think you'll be hearing some presentations coming forward in the future on cellulosic ethanol and some pilot projects for the state, especially in the Lane County area. But right now, we are years away from having the cellulosic ability for the technology-wise to have commercial development to really have a strong carbon fuel standard that utilizes Oregon agricultural crops. So while the fuel may be developed here, it's still going to be shipped from the Midwest for the inputs, And that's a concern for us because the cost that a low carbon fuel standard could have on our members purchasing fuel. We feel that Oregon agriculture can be part of the solution for climate change and are supportive of the development of renewable energies, biofuels, sequestration, and energy efficiency, but more through incentive-based programs, and would support legislation moving in that direction than new regulations and restrictions.
Thank you, Ms. Fass. Erica.
Thank you. For the record, Erica Hagedorn of Public Affairs Council here on behalf of Les Schwab. I'm sorry Mark couldn't join us today, but I bet few of you would submit that I'm more fun. Couple points. For Les Schwab, we're obviously here to talk about Section 3D of the bill, but just to follow up on what John said, this bill, just like Senate Bill 80, gives the DEQ far too much authority to not just implement what you decide, but to also set policy for Oregonians. We would submit that these policies would have an impact on the everyday lives of Oregonians and Oregon businesses, and you are the folks who would be getting the phone calls if some of these policies were implemented that weren't consumer-friendly. So we'd, first of all, like the committee to consider that piece of this legislation. The piece that we specifically want to deal with for Les Schwab is would allow the DEQ to restrict or prohibit the sale or distribution of aftermarket motor vehicle parts, including but not limited to tires. Les Schwab is tires. This bill, in our opinion, would take away choices from consumers. This looks like a green tire mandate to us. As Representative Jensen said, he has a Prius, but would you allow the DEQ to mandate that every Oregonian has to buy a Prius just because it emits fewer greenhouse gases? We'd submit probably not. Tire manufacturers know, and I'm not a tire scientist, but as Daryl Fuller said, we still don't know what a low rolling resistance tire is. There are several factors going into manufacturing a tire: tread, traction, safety, and rolling resistance. And different tire makers use a different combination of those factors to manufacture tires. Another point to this issue is that rolling resistance tires have been shown to last, to have a shorter lifespan than other tires. And so this would create more scrap tires, according to the national tire folks, and make people buy tires more often if sort of a low rolling resistance tire, whatever that means, would be mandated. We also want to share with you information about what the federal government is doing, and also California. California has been working on this issue, I think, since 2003, and they have not yet decided, after spending $1 million, on what a low greenhouse gas emitting tire is. The feds in, I believe it was 2007, and I have a couple handouts for you here, on what the feds passed about tire fuel efficiency. There's a national program that is going to come online here, I think it's supposed to be in the next couple months, on consumer information for the kind of tire efficiency that that consumers can purchase. Finally, the National Academy of Sciences, and I believe this is on your rubber manufacturer's handout, examined this issue, and they recommended tire inflation education programs. They did not recommend having tire fuel efficiency standards. That outlines the majority of our concerns, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thanks. Questions for the panel? Yeah, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Pest, I'm just curious, given your discussion around your members and biofuels and the support for the bill last session, are there criteria under which or a threshold at which a bill such as this might be acceptable to or enticing to your members?
Chair Cannon, Representative Bailey, I think the acceptability comes with the technology coming online, which it's not at this time. So for Oregon agricultural crops to be used for ethanol, cellulosic ethanol is the only way that we can go about that. Due to the enzymes that are used to develop and the cost of those enzymes at this time, the technology is not there. And so I think it's more, for my members, it's more of a time situation. So if DEQ implements rules in the next 2 years, it might be 5 or 6 before we can develop the market here in Oregon and start utilizing Oregon crops to meet that standard. And there's a lot of concern and questions on if you get the cart before the horse, will those markets be sucked up by out-of-state fuel and not allow Oregon's farmers to reach into those markets?
Katie, it strikes me that it's almost as if you've made the case for agriculture opposing the renewable fuel standard that we passed last session that relies on out-of-state imported crops, but supporting a low-carbon fuel standard, which would consider the life cycle carbon content of a fuel, meaning corn that's imported, grown with intensive fuel inputs in the Midwest, transported thousands of miles and used to produce ethanol, would be disadvantaged under a low-carbon fuel standard versus the local product grown by your members that, when the technology is available, is turned into cellulosic ethanol. That's sort of what I'm hearing.
Chair Cannon, I wasn't going to get in the details of 2210 from last session. Our position actually last session, while we ended up being in favor of the bill because of the number of incentives to move into biofuels that were in it, but on the ethanol mandate, our position was actually that it would not be triggered unless the feedstock for the ethanol came from Northwest products. So while we are supportive of 2210, we were not supportive of that one provision on the ethanol standard. If you look back at that legislation, the biodiesel standard is actually triggered by Northwest products, regional products being used for biofuel production in Oregon is what triggers the 2% biodiesel standard. Compared to the ethanol standard, that is just in-state fuel production, no matter where the feedstock comes from. I don't know if that adds to your clarification.
Isn't it the case that a low-carbon fuel standard would put locally produced fuels grown by Oregon growers at an advantage, a competitive advantage, over the imported corn that's used to produce ethanol and has larger, much larger, greenhouse gas life cycle emissions associated with it?
Chair Cannon, our feeling and our position is that there's just not the technology or the availability for a low-carbon fuel standard to work in Oregon at this time that would use Oregon crops. And so we would potentially, from the farm agricultural sector, we would be paying more for fuel to meet a low-carbon fuel standard and not receive the benefits because the technology just isn't to the point to utilize Oregon crops and have a cellulosic ethanol plant here in Oregon.
And what might it take to produce that capacity in Oregon? Could a standard like this help accelerate the technology that we'll need in order to take advantage of the kinds of crops that your members produce?
Chair Cannon, I believe that the barrier more is research and R&D technologies going forward. USDA is funding this type of research at several universities, and that is what our opinion is needed, is more of the research being developed and getting online and getting that research into a production phase than more regulations.
Thanks. Other questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Ledger, I'm interested in your remark about maybe shifting too much policymaking to the DEQ. Perhaps you could list for me some of the policy elements that you think this bill reflects a shift of. The three I saw were time, cost, and I had another one here. But are those the type of policy elements you're thinking of?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, what this really does is not so much shift, but open up. And certainly in Section 3, where it talks about, and I know this is going to be tightened up, that if it is, first of all, if something is a substance, and most things are, and if it causes or creates in any way greenhouse gas, which everything does by manufacture, disposal, or transport. So this is everything in the world. And then if there is an alternative, and there's probably an alternative to just about everything you can think of, then the EQC can essentially ban it or modify it or restrict its production. And they have to consider other things. So this is essentially a grant of legislative authority to the EQC to ban, restrict production, or sale of anything. And to me, that seems like a, you know, banning or anything in the universe would seem to me to be a logical legislative responsibility as opposed to an unelected body with an agency. But certainly things like standards, you know, and DEQ is very good at doing that. They're very good at doing technical things. But the once you give them the extraordinarily broad authority, you cannot get it back. It's gone. And you cannot override it. It's gone. And they can repeal it. If you get a different governor, it's out of your hands. And I think that is something just legislature needs to think about before they delegate.
Mr. Ledger, in your previous testimony, I think you explained how, in fact, the legislature does have the ultimate prerogative with respect to rules. And you did mention that a governor who supported the agency could veto the legislature's attempt but the legislature can override a governor's veto. We get new governors. So I think it's not strictly accurate to say that we would never get a rule back. Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you. You raised a very interesting point. Recently, in the last couple of years, I have become concerned about a slightly different issue, which I'm not going to go into today, around the delegation to the agencies of definitions and even filling in technical details about some of the things, because it requires the department to both accurately reflect what the legislative intent was, when that may not be entirely clear from the direct language of the bill. I'm wondering if an issue like the one you raised can't be at least partly cured through a sunset provision that would have the effect of requiring the legislature to either readopt the bill or to adopt something more specific at the time of the sunset.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, that's an interesting approach. And
we do it with tax laws.
You do indeed.
Where we have a problem with the asymmetric voting requirements of our Constitution around taxes. I perceive, if I may, Mr. Chair, I perceive the need for the legislature to, in fact, delegate a fair amount of authority when we're dealing with something as critically important as the climate change issue, coupled with the decline in the availability of fossil fuels, leading to our need to get to a new way of operating our economy. But the problem that you've described is one that also concerns me, because I agree with you that despite the fact that there may be some technical ways in which the legislature may be able to claw its authority back over time and under the right circumstances, as a practical matter, what you give away is gone forever unless you put a time limit on it. I would be interested in your thoughts about the possibility of using a sunset clause as a safety valve in a situation like this. And you may not have an answer today, but it may be something to think about for the future. I do expect that, without speaking for the chair, that the legislature may very well consider some fairly broad grants of authority. But I am concerned about the separation of powers and the balance of authority between the legislature and the executive branch.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, I think that's an interesting idea. The other thing that does go on here is the intent of the legislature does change with regard to rules. And I think the intent of this legislature and what's going on now might be different than the intent of a legislature 10 years ago, even though the law is the same. And certainly governors, and I used to write rules, and there are lots of different ways to write rules. You can kind of adopt your own policy and write them because you can fit them within these broad alleys of what might be legislative intent. And it's very difficult. And I don't think in many cases the legislature needs to give exceedingly broad authority. I think a legislature can kind of know what it is it wants the agency to do. And the agency can always come back and ask for more authority if it needs it.
Representative Smith, final question to this.
Great. And I want to ask the question now because it responds, thank you, Mr. Chair, because it responds or it contemplates your point, but it's actually a question that I'd like answers from a future panelist in order to make sure we get other people up. But I want to say it now. And actually, your, I think, really smart comment, Representative Barnhart, who is wicked smart, is a potential answer to my question. We are wrestling with this piece of legislation and others with the general question of where is the best place to make decisions. And we, the legislature, have a structural defect or a set of them, given that we meet for limited stretches of time with limited degrees of expertise and hope to do our best. Agencies have a different limitation in that they have a reduced degree of democratic small d accountability. Right. What I am interested in a conversation over the next days, weeks, minutes, is what creative solutions do we have, can we contemplate, to thread that needle, get some of the best parts of either or ameliorate the worst parts of both. And one possibility is, in fact, a sunset provision. Another might be something like unicameral veto of a rulemaking put in a statute. I don't know. But I am interested in this as a matter of something for us to discuss going forward.
Very quickly. There is a uniform answer to that. There's one answer to that, and that everybody will agree with. And you look at the courts, the legislature, the agency. The best place to do policy, this is what everyone will say, is where they get the best deal.
Yeah.
That's what the answer is going to be.
Hard to argue. Let's have Tim Raphael, Ivan Malisky, and Jeff Rains, please.
Present company excluded.
Tim, one of my favorite constituents, would you like to begin?
Sure, thank you. Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, Tim Raphael, I'm Government Affairs Director for Pacific Ethanol. Pacific Ethanol has owns and operates 5 ethanol production facilities in the West, including a 40 million gallon a year production plant at the Port of Morrow in Boardman, Oregon. We also received a $24.3 million grant from the U.S. Department of Energy to build the first cellulosic ethanol demonstration plant in the Pacific Northwest, which we plan to integrate into our existing facilities at Boardman. I've supplied written testimony and won't go through that word for word. I'd like to address a couple of the issues that have been raised to this point, if I could. One, in terms of the breadth of authority and policymaking, I think, and I'll speak only to the low-carbon fuel standard portion of this bill, I do think that the legislature could direct DEQ with very simple addition of language to develop a low-carbon fuel standard that would reduce the carbon intensity of fuels by 10% by 2020. We're very involved in the effort in California, crafting a low-carbon fuel standard, and efforts at the federal level in the Northeast. I'm not aware of anyone who's looking at any different standard than that one. So I think there can be a lot more clarity with a simple amendment to that portion of the bill. And then there is a tremendous amount of technical work that goes into how you, in fact, count carbon and look at the various fuel sources that is appropriate at the Department of Environmental Quality. But there is an opportunity for the legislature to let its intent be known that would be consistent with other efforts across the country. Second, in terms of some of the comments from the Farm Bureau today, and the process that we're using at the plant at Boardman. While it's true that, by and large, we're not using local corn at that plant, Oregon, in fact, grows high moisture corn that is, and there's a lack of drying capacity in the region to be able to bring it down to our moisture requirements for the plant. Oregon is a huge net importer of corn for cattle feed and has been historically. We're essentially doing a value-added process where we're taking a portion of that corn that has historically come into this state, taking the starch portion of the corn to make it into fuel, and put 100% of the protein and nutrient value of that kernel back into the local dairy and cattle feed market in Oregon and the Columbia Basin. Because of that process, which is unique among ethanol producers in the country, Oregon today has the low-carbon fuel in the marketplace in the country. California has relied on the University of California, Berkeley, for all of the life cycle analysis, taking into account all of the direct carbon impacts of the fuel from the growing of the feedstock through the transport, the production of the fuel, and even the indirect land uses. And Pacific Ethanol's model is a 16 to 40% greenhouse gas reduction improvement over conventional gasoline. That's with conventional ethanol. With our cellulosic technology, the estimates from UC Berkeley are that it could be 75% or higher reduction in greenhouse gases compared to gasoline. The work that you did in 2007 in passing the renewable fuel standard created a market in this state that attracted investment. We went from having essentially no renewable fuel production in the state to more than $500 million in capital development, with jobs going to rural communities that needed them most. And that continues to be the case. The low-carbon fuel standard could be an important next step, and all of us who testified in support of those bills in 07 recognized that that was not the end product, but rather than the beginning. And then there's an ongoing effort to improve the environmental performance of all fuels and to continue to attract investment in next-generation technologies. Pacific Ethanol is only one of several companies in Oregon and universities that are receiving federal money to do research and development of next-generation fuels. And it's here sooner, I think, than you heard from Ms. Fast at the Farm Bureau. We're prepared to break ground in 2009 for our demonstration plant that would produced 2.7 million gallons at a demonstration level, and then that is a 10x process, meaning that the plan would be to be able to boost that to 27 million gallons a year and incorporate that into our other plants as well. So again, I believe that the low-carbon fuel standard can have economic benefits to the state, just as the renewable fuel standard started us off, because, in fact, you will be relying on local feedstocks from agricultural waste, from wood chips. Our process at Boardman would be looking at waste chips from the new planer mill that Greenwood Resources is putting at the Port of Morrow, in addition to wheat straw and other local feedstocks. It does not make sense, and in fact, the bigger barrier, I think, to cellulosic ethanol production at a commercial level is not technological, but rather how far you can haul feedstocks. And so local feedstock options are going to be critically important. And I think that there's a number of folks doing very exciting work looking at ways to do local processing, to be able to take bulky by nature feedstocks and densify them to make those economics work better. But our plan, and I think certainly any economic plan to bring cellulosic ethanol or other next-generation biofuels to the state will be reliant upon local feedstocks, and we are getting that production investment in the state.
Finally, finish up, please.
One last point. I think there's a very practical reason to pass the low-carbon fuel standard now, and that is so that Oregon has a voice and is a stakeholder in the existing rulemaking processes in California at EPA and other states, so that we can make sure that our interests are being addressed and that we don't become, as I think Ms. Durbin from OEC talked about, become either a dumping ground for high-carbon fuels that are no longer viable in other states, or looking for the best possible way to incorporate a low-carbon fuel standard that works for Oregon. So I urge your support and appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thanks very much. Ivan.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ivan Molusky, the conservation coordinator with the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club. We're a statewide conservation organization with over 20,000 members in all parts of the state. We thank you for the opportunity to come testify in support of House Bill 2186 today. Our members across Oregon have a strong interest in state action to address global climate change and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And I wanted to make one observation here, which is that over the last few years working on these issues, I've noticed that there are a lot of the similar faces come up and oppose these bills. And it seems to me sometimes an argument of convenience for the day that we're in. Some of the same folks testifying against this bill today were just last year testifying against simply a bill that would have allowed DEQ to start registration and reporting greenhouse gas emissions. And so I'm concerned that I just want to be careful that you folks don't allow folks who have taken a head-in-the-sand approach, if you will, to dissuade you from really looking seriously at these issues as we move forward. But to the bill at hand, HB 2186 provides the state with important new tools to proactively address emissions from transportation fuel vehicles and other products to meet the state's legislatively adopted greenhouse gas reduction goals. As I mentioned last week in the debate over Senate Bill 80, if these goals are to be meaningful, state agencies need to be able to develop policies with appropriate public input and consideration of all factors to enable us to meet these goals. Contrary to the concerns that such state action will be costly, we believe this legislation will ultimately result in energy cost savings to consumers and businesses, create public health benefits that save money for businesses, workers, and consumers as the state shifts to cleaner burning, less toxic, and safer transportation fuels, and it will ultimately enhance consumer choice with regard to cleaner and more energy and fuel-efficient products. As it helps meet the state's greenhouse gas reduction goals, this bill will build on the record of the Oregon legislature in support of the alternative fuels industry in the state, as Tim mentioned, a growing sector that provides economic opportunities across rural Oregon. This bill will stimulate new innovations in a variety of sectors. One only has to look at last summer's sky-high gas prices and the plight of the Detroit automakers to see where a lack of innovation and resistance to providing choices to meet consumer demand around fuel efficiency can lead us. Through the passage of House Bill 2186, Oregon can help stimulate innovation and economic activity and ultimately save consumers and businesses money while reducing air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. So we're thankful for the time today and urge your support.
Thanks, Ivan. Mr. Raines.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Raines. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Diesel Brewing based here in Salem, Oregon. I guess a brief explanation of where we are and what we do. Much like my partner on the panel here, we're in the process of developing a cellulosic, a plant that will utilize cellulosic non-food-based feedstock to create biodiesel and or biobutanol, which is a product that can be used as either an additive, well, in particularly an additive to either gasoline or diesel. The reason that we're here today is looking a little bit at what we would consider the next generation fuels. Biobutanol would be one of those fuels. Right now, Oregon is at a bit of a disadvantage when you look at some of what would be the second generation fuels that are coming down the road. Biobutanol currently has been approved by a number of agencies, federal agencies that allow the process of creating biobutanol. In our case, we're using a non-food-based source, and in Oregon, as I understand it today, we would not be allowed to use biobutanol as a fuel in Oregon, even if it is created by a non-food-based biomass. So our hope is that the committee will certainly consider the opportunity of adding a secondary fuels like biobutanol. The attributes are excellent. It's a high BTU sort of fuel. When added to diesel, it actually helps things like gelling. As an example, low-temperature diesel typically gels. Biobutanol would help in gelling environments, which is a great thing for agricultural, military applications, and so on. I guess my final point is about the life cycle that's been discussed here a bit today. Because we're looking at putting plants in local communities here in Oregon, we do reduce the number of miles that fuel travels to get to the farm to our citizens. If we can't sell or market products like biobutanol here, obviously we can't put a plant here. We'd have to put a plant elsewhere and ship product in. Our feedstock essentially is local, so we're not looking at shipping stuff 100 or more miles. There is that distance sensitivity to shipping in feedstock of that kind. So my request today is that you consider the secondary fuels and see if we can add some of those to the list.
Thanks very much for being here, Mr. Raines, and for bringing this fuel on that issue in statute to our attention. Before I go to questions, let me give give members a sense of where we're headed. We have two more panels of four people each, one panel opposed, one panel supportive, and I want to leave at least 10 minutes to bring DEQ back up to talk about their consideration of next steps on the bill and respond to some of what they've heard. So time probably for maybe a question or two of this panel, and then I want to make sure that we hear from the other eight folks who have signed up to be here today. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I would like to make a comment on Mr. Molesky's testimony. I think you do your group a disservice by impugning some people's opinions on an issue when they come before this body. And, you know, that's, I represent a lot of people, both pro and con, on lots of issues, and that's something that I keep in mind at all times, that at least some of my constituents are on the other side of any given issue. And with that, what I wanted to ask, and I don't know, some of the maybe innovator guys up there might know of a project that is in, like a pilot project that might be coming forward down in Representative Barnhart's area to make some sort of kind of fuel out of straw, grass straw. So, and it's something that's been brought forward by the grass seed industry to try to get down on the burning of the fields and use the what's left of the fields to make a fuel. I'm not sure about this, but I know that there's been some, and I don't see Farm Bureau here, but I see a nod.
Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, I'm aware of the Willamette Biomass Collaborative, and I'm not sure whether there's someone here planning to testify. They would be able to speak to that much better than I am, but I am aware that there's an effort going on there.
Sounds like something perhaps we could explore
yeah,
another.
I was going to say if you could find that out.
Mr. Chair, we had a presentation in the Ag Committee this morning, and you're right on. It would be excellent for this committee to hear, too.
Super. Other questions for the panel? Seeing none. Thank you very much. Let's have the Brian Doherty, Mel Yeager, Lana Butterfield, and Nick Choi. And I'm not sure if Nick is testifying in favor or against, but come on up, Nick, and we'll hear from those folks. Mr. Doherty, do you want to start?
Thank you, Chair Cannon, members of the committee, Brian Doherty from Miller Nash, testifying here on behalf of the Western States Petroleum Association. I happen to be one that was testifying for the greenhouse gas reporting bill the last time. Our companies believe very strongly that if you're going to adopt some type of cap-and-trade program, that stringent reporting of carbon emissions with third-party verification is very important, just to put myself on the record there. One of the issues I have with 2186, John Ledger has addressed, and that is this delegation of authority. To answer Representative Barnhart a little bit, I think there are many law firms like mine that have kept their utility bills paid by the gap between legislative intent and regulatory implementation. And what I want to offer is a solution. We lead the nation in alternative fuels use. We're right now blending over 10 billion gallons of ethanol in America. We have a national renewable fuel standard. We are moving. Fuels are not stagnant right now, and we're not getting dirtier. We have a renewable fuel standard federally that says we have to blend 36 billion gallons by 2022, 21 billion gallons of which have to be second-generation renewable fuels. One of our companies is developing butanol right now, and they are spending millions on that to come up with another second-generation fuel. Another company of ours has got thin film technology that is improving the battery life for fuel cells, for battery cells, or excuse me, electric cells. There's a lot going on in this. What is the concern I have here? Oregon doesn't get its fuel from California. Following the California low-carbon fuel standard makes no sense. We get over 85% of our fuel from Washington. Washington doesn't have a low-carbon fuel standard on its books or in a bill form in this legislative session. What we do have is a lot going on in Oregon. Oregon has a low-carbon fuel standard. You passed it in 2007. That's called E10B2. You have a 10% ethanol. That's 160 million gallons of ethanol being blended approximately right now, today, that you weren't blending, or not that much were you blending in 2007. You have options to go here that I think need some thought process for you to make a decision, and Representative Bentz mentioned what would be some of the policy decisions. A couple of things would be, what is the cost effectiveness of a low-carbon fuel standard? This isn't the only way to lower carbon, is a low-carbon fuel standard. We seem to be saying, here's our five things, and we've got nothing else to look at. The WCI has included fuels in its cap-and-trade program effective in 2015. There's a reason they delayed it from 2012 to 2015. So we have things going on. Maybe it's better to do this in a cap-and-trade. That's where WCI is sending us. If you don't have an option, and right now there is a major gap between technologically feasible, cellulosic ethanol is technologically feasible, and the other gap is to get to commercially available. Commercially available is a long way away in terms of time and dollars to get there. So we don't have enough blended or vehicles that could take it from electric from this point. So I'm going to end just saying that we are willing to work with DEQ. We think there are many options to do this. There is a lot going on in this fuels area, and we're willing to work with them, but we would urge you to have DEQ come back with several policy points for you to make a decision in 2011 on whether this is the best way to go forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Yeager or Ms. Butterfield?
Looked like Representative Smith had a question.
Go ahead. We'll save the questions till the end of the panel.
Representative Cannon and members of the committee, my name is Mel Yeager. For the record, I represent Bike Pack of Oregon, which is the political arm of all motorcyclists of Oregon. And I'm here specifically to speak about motorcyclists and their role in this bill. However, my comments could and should be also including all vehicles on the road. House Bill 2186 is a bill that is not necessary as far as motorcyclists and vehicle owners are concerned. There's the part that I'm referring to specifically is the right to manufacture or to repair or to modify your vehicles, whether it be an old classic car or a motorcycle that you can't get parts for or whatever anymore. It could be an old show bike or a show car, maybe not even used on the road. But to not allow people to buy parts that are no longer manufactured is not the way to go. We should allow these things to be bought by the owners and the operators of those vehicles if they want. It has nothing to do with DEQ. At all appearances, this bill appears to be something that the auto and motorcycle manufacturers of the United States has put together to kind of feather their own nest and to protect their own interests in repairing motorcycles and cars. They want the right to only be the ones that work on their vehicles, as it appears. And there are a huge amount of collectible cars and motorcycles in Oregon that you can't even get parts for anymore. You have to buy them off market from people out of state many times. Have to go online to buy your parts. The dealers don't even have these things anymore. And in order to get them and keep their vehicles show worthy or even ride worthy, this is where they got to get those parts. So why would we want to restrict the people under these conditions? And since it was brought up so stringently over the past couple of hours of testimony, the matter of ethanol in the gasoline, this is something that motorcyclists hate because sometimes their vehicles park over the winter with gasoline in the tanks, and the ethanol sitting in those tanks is not good for motorcycles, nor is it good for your small engines like your lawnmowers or your rototillers for your garden and such as that. I talked to the dealers in Albany area and repair shops, and universally they are opposed to having ethanol in the gasoline. They don't like it. They say that in one respect, you have to buy more gas, which is good for their business, but they also see a lot of repair work from people that have to bring their cars in because ethanol has damaged them. And so we're totally opposed to the use of ethanol in the gasoline from our motorcyclist point of view. Cars can maybe get by with it, but motorcyclists are having a tough time with it and causing a lot more costs and expenses in repairs and upkeep of those vehicles. And with that, I'll close, and I'll ask if anybody has any questions.
Well, hold on to questions. I can assure you, Mr. Yeager, on your comments on the use of aftermarket parts, you represent thousands of people who have been contacting our office, our offices over the last week, and as I've mentioned before, we'll hear from DEQ about their intentions with that provision of the bill in a few minutes. But thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Lana.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm here today representing the Northwest Propane Gas Association. And I want to tell you that I sat with Brian when we both supported the reporting requirements, and I hope that that language makes it out of any bill, makes it into any bill that might come out of this, and I'll have a conversation with you later, Mr. Chair, about that. I want to explain our propane dealers' ambivalence about this bill, and the best way to do that is to paint you a picture about propane on wheels versus propane in a tank sitting in your yard, because that's really what it's about. And to be able to do this, I have to talk about two issues, the low-carbon fuel standard versus the idling section. But before I do that, I want to tell you that propane is a low-carbon fuel, and I've attached a press release, and I have a copy of the actual study, and if anybody wants this larger study, I'm happy to give it to you. I didn't print a whole bunch of paper for you, though, today. It produces fewer greenhouse gas emissions than many other fuels, which is great. So at first blush, you would think, hey, you know, they should love this bill, but we've been wondering what the effect really is for propane. I want to give you a picture of what the transportation side of this is right now. Passenger vehicles can use propane, and there are some that have been modified to do so. There's not many here in Oregon who do. There are some fleets. There's a school bus fleet and a bakery and so on. But it's the problem is when you get into the larger vehicles, those cannot use propane very well. It's not the fuel of choice because the engines break down. That's not to say that there might not be, you know, some innovation in the future. But that poses a problem for our dealers because they use diesel engines, you know, to go around and deliver their fuel, their propane. So, you know, that's one of our ambivalencies about this bill because we have the same concerns that other truckers do. The other thing has to do with the idling section. We can't deliver propane without being able to idle and use our trucks to pump fuel into the home propane tank. And so we would want to make sure that if this bill should pass out, that there are some amendments that give us some greater surety about the ability to continue to do that. I have been talking with DEQ about this issue, and if there is going to be any kind of work group, I would be pleased to work with them on the issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel?
Yeah.
Representative Smith.
Yeah. First, just a comment. I just wanted to note Mr. Doherty's support for WCI's cap and trade proposal. But the my question, sir, what miles per gallon? What kind of bike do you ride?
I ride a Harley Davidson, a 1991 Harley Davidson FLHT Ultra Classic. It's a big,
beautiful
dress motorcycle.
What miles per gallon do you get?
I was getting right about 45 miles to the gallon with my wife on the back on a long trip.
Yeah. So my impression is that respecting motorcycles' miles per gallon is probably a smart thing either for DEQ to do or for us to suggest in the bill. I'm done with my questions.
Very good. Thank you very much, and appreciate you being here. Let's have Catherine Thomason, Dana Kay, John Herring,
And Lisa Adato, if we can find a fourth seater, you can be on deck. Yeah, and while you're coming up, we have a few letters that I want to recognize for the record. One is on behalf of the Air Conditioning, Heating, and Refrigeration Institute. Another from the City of Portland. And a third from Mr. Steve McDonald of the Specialty Equipment Market Association. Go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Cannon and the committee. And on behalf of the committee, I'm Catherine Thomason. I'm a physician with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, representing 1,700 members in the state. And speaking on behalf of this bill, obviously we are very concerned about the public health impact of climate change, and the efforts in this bill to reduce greenhouse gases is absolutely essential. Obviously we're still going to heat up 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit even if we do everything and the entire world does the same. Otherwise, business as usual will be 11 degrees warmer. A recent report on Rogue Valley shows that summertime temperatures in the best scenario are going to be 8 degrees Fahrenheit hotter, and in the worst scenario, 15 degrees. So we are talking a huge impact on public health. Obviously, this particular bill also increases ground level ozone because of transportation from car and the car and truck emissions, resulting in further epidemic of asthma cases and exacerbations of and deaths due to individuals with cardiac and pulmonary disease. Recent estimate in the state of Washington, this hasn't been done for Oregon yet, by 2020 we will, because of ozone alone, we will have $1.2 billion worth of health care cost elevation. But to speak specifically to this bill, I feel we do need a low-carbon fuel standard to provide a flexible way of reduction of reliance on foreign oil. And with a well-designed fuel standard, the fuel suppliers will using life cycle analysis, will best provide the means of doing so. Fuel efficiency is also a function of the vehicle itself, so the contingency to allow and require maintenance and retrofitting to reduce aerodynamics obviously makes good sense. Personally, it was a pleasure to be at the opening of the plug-in truck stop segment of the Jubits truck stop in Portland a year or two ago. There are excellent studies that show that the health of the drivers when they are able to turn their vehicles off markedly improves their safety performance. Also, the reduction of exposure along with the public exposure to the diesel fumes by not allowing idling for that full 8 hours for safety purposes that otherwise the truck would need to keep running for heating, cooling, or other functions for the driver or for the truck. Because independent truckers are reimbursed only for fuel and not for plug-ins, without this bill, retrofits would not occur because the individual truckers wouldn't have the ability to pay for the retrofitting to allow plug-in. As a biker in a city, I try to avoid high diesel and high emission traffic areas and feel that electricity generated, even by the most inefficient plant, is still more efficient than running a truck on diesel for in-cab use. So thank you for allowing me to testify on this reasonable and practical bill.
Thanks, Dr. Thomason. Go ahead.
Hello, my name is Dana Kay, and I'm the Executive Director for the American Lung Association of Oregon. So, Chairman Cannon and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today. I'm here, obviously, to testify in support of House Bill 2186. The American Lung Association of Oregon has been working to reduce the amount of diesel emissions in our state because of their negative impact on lung health of Oregonians and, in particular, children. House Bill 2186, especially Section 3F, will allow the Environmental Quality Commission to establish restrictions on engine use, idling, of parked commercial vehicles and include medium and heavy-duty trucks. We also are interested in ships at port. That's another piece of pollution that we're particularly worried about. In addition to reducing greenhouse gases, these anti-idling strategies are ideal for reducing toxic diesel pollution and the public health risks that are associated with it. In 2007, we worked with stakeholders to establish the Clean Diesel Program here in Oregon, which continues to provide grants to retrofit or replace old diesel engines with clean burning technology. This program had wide support in the 2007 legislature, and it was a great step forward for Oregon. House Bill 2186 is a critical next step, and we appreciate you looking at it thoroughly and remembering that every policy we have has an effect on health. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. I, too, was one of the many people who...
Introduce yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. My name is John Herring. I started to type out one of the, sounds like, kabillion emails that you guys have received in reference to aftermarket automotive parts, and felt it was probably better if I brought a written copy as well as summarized it here for you. Might get a little bit more weight. I am the marketing director for ASMC Limited. We are an aftermarket automotive parts manufacturer and distributor headquartered in Hillsboro, Oregon. I was very concerned when I saw House Bill 2186 come through the committee, specifically, of course, referencing that Section 3, Paragraph D, that it restricts and prohibits the sale and distribution of the aftermarket motor vehicle products. The biggest problem that I have is that the vague language, looking at it from our perspective, can cause a race to the bottom, which forces motor vehicle parts manufacturers to produce products which only aim to reduce greenhouse gases while placing little, if no, value on performance or safety of those particular products. Furthermore, this bill would unfairly exempt OEM products and establish them as the standard for which all other products should be compared. An aftermarket product, which could be an acceptable replacement on one vehicle, the identical product would be illegal simply based on the OEM product for another vehicle. I'm asking the members of this community to either change, if not remove, this dangerous language before it moves out of the committee. If the full House is given the bill with no changes, I fear that House members may vote to pass it in efforts to support the governor's green initiatives without understanding that a yes vote would place the job of regulating state commerce in the hands of the EQC, which is an all-volunteer citizen panel with no requirements to consider cost tax basis or related job losses from overregulation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Cannon, my name is Lisa Addato, and I'm here with a group called Climate Solutions. Thank you for allowing me a chance to testify today. And I won't go through all my testimony. Many of the points that I've made have on my paper have been made already. But I would like to say that our group is a group that's been around for over a decade, a premier climate group. And over a decade ago, we realized that in order to pass meaningful climate legislation, we'd have to find methods to align climate legislation with economic gains. So to that end, we've looked for policies that actually promote economic development and jobs while at the same time reducing climate pollution. And one of our key points is that we'd like to find a way to get beyond the argument about economic prosperity and climate. We'd like to see ways to make those win-win. We just don't think that's a valid argument in many cases. We think in many cases we can actually promote new jobs, new opportunities, maintain existing jobs, and reduce climate pollution. And this bill, I believe, is an example of that. And I'm going to particularly talk about the low carbon fuel standard. One of the excellent things about the low carbon fuel standard is it helps produce new markets. And this has a number of different benefits for Oregon. One is new jobs, and we've heard quite a bit of testimony here from producers of ethanol, and last week from people that were involved in electrification and new kinds of technology. So clearly there's just new business opportunities. Another benefit to our economy is competition. When you have competing alternative fuels, you'll have pressure on the existing fuel system to keep prices lower. Competition can help our economy because it gives people more choices. there's other benefits, too, that might not be so obvious. And one is that we're hearing from manufacturers and producers throughout Oregon that they're being pressured, particularly by Walmart, but also by consumers in general, to look at the carbon footprint of their products to the extent that our fuels give people an ability to transport things in a lower carbon manner will actually make our products more competitive here in Oregon, and that's quite important for Oregon. My next point is that, in fact, it's quite difficult.
Lisa, we are getting pressed for time, so
okay.
I'm going to ask you to finish
I'll be
up
really quick.
Pretty quickly. Thanks.
It's difficult to establish new markets. You've heard people come here and talk about biofuels, and I read a long article in the Wall Street Journal last year about how California had been working for decades to establish alternatives to gasoline. It's not easy. You have to have investors and infrastructures, brave business executives that are willing to work for years to establish new products. And you need to develop competitive strategies against well-established industries. And all of that is quite difficult. So I'd like to just make the point that we need policy to support the development of these new markets. And it really won't harm our economy. It will help our economy. It's not something that we can take for granted, however. So I think this bill is an example of one of those climate policies where we can see both a reduction in global warming pollution, but also true economic benefits for Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And any quick questions for this panel? Thanks very much for being here. I saw Jim Walsh come into the room. He was on last week's sign-up sheet. Jim, if you could come up, and Andy Ginsberg from DEQ, why don't you come up as well? The unique pairing.
Mr. Chair, while they're getting settled, I would like to just thank John, I can't remember your last name, but for actually one of the hundreds of people who actually came forward and made the time to come down here and let us know what that, you know, what your thoughts were. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Go ahead, Jim.
Chair Cannon, committee members, Jim Welsh representing Oregon Cattlemen Association, and I did provide some written testimony there, too, with some questions and certainly concerns about this legislation. And you heard from those who were concerned about the delegation of your decision-making and power to EQC, and DEQ, we're concerned about that, too. We don't think that should be done. I represent... probably thousands of trucks of all sizes, small, medium, and large. And in fact, one of our members owns 35 trucks that move in and out of Oregon, large trucks moving cattle. And so they're very concerned about this piece of legislation, too, and what it will eventually cost them, and not only in fuel standards, but in the possibility that they need to retrofit. Another concern, and one of our questions, is certainly the idea that we in Oregon can make a difference here in Oregon, but we have so many people that are visiting from out of state throughout the year, and especially through the nice weather months, and what is that going to mean? We cannot control their emissions. And so, really, what kind of benefit are we going to expect and will really be a return on the change or investment that we make here? And so those are very big concerns to us. And will the independent truckers, trucking companies, and corporate trucking be able to afford the initial cost of those retrofit requirements and the cost to maintain them without passing on excessive costs to those needing their service and ultimately the consumer? And that's what we're concerned about, too. The ranching and farming industry is rather marginal, and any increase. And yes, there are things that we're doing, and it's certainly around efficiencies and conservation. You have to understand that a rancher is looking to save money everywhere they can, and it may be in very minuscule measures that they take, and that may be in the fuel economy of their vehicle, and even maybe in the tires that they buy. But they make those independent of regulation. And they do that because they're pushed to do that because they're business people. And I think, and a lot of our members think, that this is going too fast and too far at this point in time. Let's let some of our people, our business people, make some good decisions around our commitment in this state. And at the national level, we can do some things around at the same thing. And if they require even cap and trade and some other things, that at least at national level in the competitive issue that our business people have to contend with in this state, and we are regulated or over-regulated as we perceive in this piece of legislation, that has to be considered too. And so it may, in our estimation, definitely be going too far, too fast at this point in time. Please consider the obvious and immediate consequences and the unintended consequences of this legislation. Please do not pass the excessive cost of this legislation to the industries and consumers of Oregon.
Thanks, Mr. Welsh. Any questions for him? I want to allow Mr. Ginsburg to sort of finish up by telling us what his thoughts may be and next steps may be for the agency. So we'll reserve the balance of time for him. But let's, before we excuse Jim, anything? Thanks.
Another hearing I got to run to.
Super. Thank you. Andy, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Andy Ginsburg, Air Quality Administrator, DEQ. I have passed around a letter that I sent to you, Mr. Chair, that provides some additional information in response to questions that you asked me at the last hearing. And the gist of it is that we recognize that there are going to be a number of amendments needed to this legislation. We've been in contact, as you heard, from many of your many of the people who testified. We've been in contact with them. We've heard what their concerns are about the language. And we recognize that we're going to be working with them to develop amendments to the bill. Specifically with regard to the auto parts industry, I'd like to say that the intent of the bill was not to unfairly pick on the aftermarkets industry. There were some unfortunate choices of words in that legislation. I have been working with the trade associations, and we will come up with some better wording, and it will address the concerns that we heard raised here today. So, Mr. Chair, without going through the letter, just my intent is to work with each of the sectors. We have amendments that we'll be making with regard to the low-carbon fuel standard, with the greenhouse gas containing substances, with the aftermarket parts, with the idling. I will note that agriculture is exempt from air quality regulation in Oregon, so that none of the idling regulations or aftermarket parts provisions would apply to agriculture at all. Although, agriculture is a consumer of fuel, and to the extent that this affects the fuel that they buy, they could be indirectly affected. As we heard from California when they called in for testifying last hearing, they don't expect this to drive fuel prices up, but of course we don't know for sure at this point. So I'm not saying that there's no impact at all in agriculture, just that they're exempt from our direct regulation. So with that, I think I should just see if there are any questions from the committee. I just want to let everyone know that we've heard their concerns about the language. We will be providing, working with the stakeholders to develop amendments, and I think those amendments will provide the appropriate sidebars that hopefully will get us closer to the balance that you're all looking for in terms of the policy decisions being made by the legislature and then the technical implementation details being figured out through the rulemaking process.
Thanks, Andy. And since we've heard so much about the aftermarket parts, could you just clarify what the intent was with that provision of the bill and give us some sense of how you might move forward with sidebars or with clarification around that section?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I believe that we're talking really more about replacement parts. Aftermarket parts, as I've learned over the last few weeks, has a very specific meaning, and it distinguishes between the businesses that make aftermarket parts and the businesses that make original equipment parts. And the concern really is not about who's selling it or requiring original equipment. The issue is that when cars are sold new, they have a certain level of performance with regard to fuel economy and greenhouse gas emissions. And there are some changes that people can make to their cars that could significantly increase their emissions. And the prime example that we're focused on right now does have to do with the tires, and the issue with tires is twofold. One is that tires over time will lose their air pressure and need to be refilled. And then also tires have a certain rolling resistance. With regard to air pressure, actually let me back up and just say that California has been working on this, as you heard in testimony, for a while. They have not yet proposed a regulation, but the California Energy Commission is considering a three-part approach to this. And phase one would be an outreach and education step. Phase two would be to look at this question of holding the air pressure and looking at how well the tire is sealed. And apparently there are some things that could be done to improve the seals on tires without at all affecting the types of tires that could be sold. And then phase three, they're considering looking at setting standards for rolling resistance. My understanding is that there's a great variation in rolling resistance in all classes of tires. So you could have high performance tires, you might have some that have high rolling resistance and some that have lower rolling resistance, and then other types of tires also that type of variation. So with a program that California is considering, there would be quite a long phase-in period, there'd be stages, and the idea would be to set standards that would help enable the manufacturers to gradually move towards tires that still meet all those performance goals that they have, and still provide all of the choices that consumers are going to want. But within each choice category, we're moving more towards the lower rolling resistance tires within that category. So the idea would, the program in the end wouldn't ban any products at all, but rather would set standards for the overall replacement tire sector, whether those are sold by aftermarket parts suppliers or original equipment suppliers. excuse me. So that's kind of the way California is looking at it. We would watch what California is doing, and we would evaluate how that works and consider whether work closely, of course, with the stakeholders and design a program that might work for Oregon. I really think that the first steps of it are going to focus on tire pressure.
And we can expect an amendment that will clarify that's the direction you're headed.
Absolutely.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here again. I'll look forward to looking at this more closely, and I appreciate you bringing it. I hope that it addresses some of my concerns, because I have many. But let me ask you this. I have two quick questions. The first is, would you entertain an amendment, or be supportive of an amendment, I should say, because the chair has to entertain the amendment, but if in order to get around this motorcycle issue, would you entertain an amendment or be supportive that would exempt them out of this bill, motorcycles, or at the minimum, classic motorcycles?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I absolutely agree with Representative Smith's comment that motorcycles, because they get such high miles per gallon, are by their very nature a greenhouse gas reduction strategy, and the intent here is not to affect motorcycles. We can either directly, I know that the amendments that we'll come up with will address that concern. I don't know exactly how we'll do it yet.
Okay, and then one follow-up. Hello. I'm still concerned about this area of handing over to you this authority that you may not even want. Maybe you do, maybe you don't, but it's the issue that we've talked a little bit about today earlier. I think you were here. Goals. Are we talking about reference targets? You know, that's one issue for me. Or are we talking about moving towards mandatory standards? What's your interpretation of that? What do you think of this so far? And maybe you've addressed it in the new document that I haven't read.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I may have partially addressed it. In the document, I just responded to the Chair's question where he asked for other examples where the legislature has delegated authority to agencies to develop rules and what our process then is in rulemaking. So I don't think it probably completely answers your question. I think let me say specifically with the low carbon fuel standard, that the details of that standard need to be worked out through the rulemaking process, but the goals for the standard, the direction of the standard, the need for it to take into account cost to ensure that we have adequate fuel availability, that it's phased in a way that enables the the technology to develop. Those are the types of direction that the legislature can provide to our commission to ensure that the final rulemaking ends up being practical, effective, cost-effective, feasible, safe. And that's our intent. But all of the details of the proposal being in statute, I don't think would work because it's such a rapidly evolving field. And as California and the Northeast states change their program, or as new technologies are developed, I think we would put ourselves at a great disadvantage if our process was too cumbersome to update. I think we need to find the appropriate balance. And I'm hoping that in working with the stakeholders, we can bring that to you. And we'll just have to see if that works.
My last comment, if you allow me.
Final comment?
For now. Is just simply, for me, the only thing that we want to move toward is sticking with the goal, not leaving it so wide open that you could vacillate towards mandatory standards. That's the thing I'm concerned about. And you left yourself a lot of leeway there, and I might do the same thing in your shoes, but it concerns me. And offline, we can talk about this. In my view, if you want to do something about tires, have you heard of Reclaim up in Boardman?
No.
Let's talk about it, because that's nothing to do with this bill, but everything to do with meaningful change in the way we deal with tires.
Representative Boone, did you have a...
Oh, I just wanted to thank Andy for coming back and making available this letter to us to explain some of these things and willingness to work in the group of stakeholders, because I think this is the kind of issue that will come out a much better product at the end with everybody's input. So.
I appreciate that. Thanks, Representative Boone. Representative Smith.
Thanks. Two things. One to the room. Information would be valuable to me. It's a place for good data, or just the good data itself, around net carbon and energy savings or cost around ethanol. I've been hearing different things. Happy to talk to you about it or hear stuff from you. In the interest of time, I didn't ask sort of the panel of people to talk about that because I knew that would require three answers in 10 minutes. The second thing I wanted to say is, and you may have a response to it right now, I think there is, I at least, have a significant interest in figuring out what's the best process for us to go forward. I won't repeat what I said earlier, but I actually think that Mr. Ledger helped me very strongly make my point that most of the time when I'm hearing testimony, I am hearing it through a filter of this is what would be best for our interests in terms of how we see the final result. Final result I'm most interested in is what's better for the common interest, right? And I want a process that over time will more likely yield the common interest. And that might be broad handing over to agencies. I got worried about that. I have some worries about that. It might be almost never. I have worries about that. So whether it's the sunsetting deal or something weird, count me as your huckleberry if you're interested in thinking about something weird and if there's anybody else who wants to do something weird. All right.
Thank you.
Any other final questions or comments? Representative Bailey, you look like you may be hatching something weird.
Mr. Chair, I can't top the weirdness that was that Huckleberry comment, and was simply going to make a snide remark and decided better of it.
Take it offline.
Oh,
well, thanks, Andy, and I would echo Representative Boone's gratitude for your willingness to sort of stay engaged and work with the stakeholders on this. I'm also interested in Representative Smith's question about process. Thanks to the folks who testified over 2 days. We've heard from 30 people on this bill. We've heard from hundreds more via email. I'm sure we will continue to look forward to seeing some amendments and keeping in close touch with you and the other folks who are interested in this bill. So thanks very much. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2 days with this, 2186, and close the Committee on Environment and Water.